The Ayaan Institute is a newly established independent think tank based in London, the United Kingdom, and the vision of the institute is to see a Muslim world that is united, independent, strong, prosperous, free of wars and conflict, and capable of resolving its own issues. And recently, the Institute issued a report, a very thought-provoking report called Creating a New Civilization of Islam, wherein it identifies 12 approaches or factors that can help create greater solidarity between Muslims around the world. And it's our great honor in a bit to be welcoming to the show Jahangir Mohammed, the director of the Ayaan Institute. Just a bit about him. He's a prolific writer, thinker, and commentator on Muslim affairs with a 28-year experience of studying and analyzing Islamic movements. And during this period, he has written numerous articles, opinion pieces, and has been a regular commentator in Muslim and mainstream media. He's the author of this report. And there's so much to unpack in this report called Creating a New Civilization of Islam, Strategies for Renewal. But we'll obviously try to drop some hints, give you a feel of what the report is all about, what's the vision of the Institute, and thereafter probably hear from him as to how he hopes Muslim communities, including those tuning in this evening, would interact with this report. Jahangir, a great pleasure speaking to you, and shukran for joining us this evening. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Assalamu alaikum to you and your listeners, and jazakallah khair for having me on your program. It's a great pleasure, as always, to speak to our brothers in South Africa.
The pleasure is mutual, and jazakallah khairan for joining us, which I believe is a very important discussion. It's an ambitious discussion in the approach that you've taken, trying to map out a new vision entirely based on the challenges that lay ahead, the present challenges as well as current realities for a new civilization and renewal of Islamic civilization. Just a bit about before the report, newly established Ayaan Institute, what exactly are the ideas that you have in mind?
Well, I think the Institute was established first of all to provoke new thought and ideas about the problems the Muslim world faces. As you know, and we hear all the time and we see things, the climate had become very pessimistic, and also in some cases, the discussions are very negative and pessimistic and not very hopeful since the war on terror started, and Muslims seems to have become more disunited, factionalized into groupism. And this is not really a surprise, given that if you analyze George W. Bush's speech when he launched the war on terror, one of the things he said is we will turn them one against the other. And in fact, that's happened. And of course, what we thought was really there was a need for a think tank to focus on the problems of the Muslim world, and in particular on unity, which is the forgotten obligation of Islam, as I say, and to create the think tank really. The modern world is based on think tanks and not so much on academic institutes like the past, but about thinking, about framing, creating frameworks, analyzing, and putting those ideas out in easy, understandable language. And we don't seem to have done that. We don't have many think tanks at all. We thought this was a think tank particularly focused on unification and unity of Muslims, which asks the provocative questions, analyzes things, and ultimately to create a new consciousness. Change only comes when you implant those ideas in people and you create a new consciousness amongst the masses. We felt that there was a lip service to unity, and that we needed also to show some practical steps, because whatever the state of our world and the governments that we have. Even if they change tomorrow, the legacy of colonialism and the legacy of division and destruction of Islamic institutions is so deep that this work will have to be done anyway. And we thought this is the Institute should focus on this and try to embed those ideas and that work in the Ummah at a grassroots level, at a civil society level, and hopefully some governments will take note as well and try to change. So that's the rather ambitious aim. Dream big. Imagine the world as you want to see it, but start with the world as it is at the moment.
I it triggers a thought within me that we have lots of Muslim movements, organizations, and so forth. Hardly much mention, although there would be a few of Muslim think tanks. When you map out the role for think tanks in the world, could you illustrate for us how important think tanks are and how what was once on paper or on the cloud at certain think tanks actually physically and tangibly shapes the world a few years later?
Well, I think one of the things we can see, certainly for somebody like myself who's been studying Western policies and politics and its impact on the Muslim world for a very long time, even before the war on terror, you could see the direction that starting from Reagan after the fall of communism, that Islam was being set up as a bogeyman, the next challenge along with China, the green peril and the yellow peril. And all this work and thinking was done not in universities initially, but around think tanks, thinkers, ideologues. And we see how they've flourished, really. You can name lots here in the UK, the whole countering violent extremism policy and ideas have been, like the Henry Jackson Society is one, the Center for Policy Studies. Even in the Thatcher era, we had the Institute for Economic Affairs, the Center for Policy Studies, these type of institutes, which really shaped ideas and thoughts. And then they have attached to them people in the media, in journalism, and they impart those ideas. So what we have is a total sort of narrative that has been created, a thought process, a framework around Islam and Muslims, which Muslims to some extent themselves have adopted. And here in the UK, a lot of our energies, and certainly mine for the last couple of decades, has been solely focused on that and trying to analyze it, trying to make people aware. So we have been doing that work, and we thought now it was time to extend it on a global scale and continue it and formalize it a bit more with social media use social media to get those messages out a little bit more. So we can see that the whole world, really, foreign policy, even the wars, these ideas have been shaped by military think tanks, political think tanks in the US, and in a way, the whole of the far-right movement or the Trump movement, we can see how they've created a new white identitarian movement right across Europe, in fact. We have here, Nigel Farage, who was a fairly insignificant person, but because of his contacts, because of these think tanks, he's managed to become one of the most important politicians, and his ideas have taken root. And we, as you know, in the UK have exited from the European Union now, purely because of the ideas and efforts of him initially, and the think tanks around him.
Jahangir, this almost 100-page report that you have produced, and as I mentioned, very extremely thought-provoking, creating a new civilization of Islam, strategies for renewal. Now, I mean, when one fleshes around words like renewal, awakening, reform, you know, people might go and you know, nod their heads and say, we've heard these already. Is this not, you know, the question could be asked, is this not, a similar analysis was reached or similar sort of thinking went into the creation of different, the bouquet of Islamic movements, organizations that are out there. And, you know, people did a diagnosis of what they thought the problems were in the world, the problems in the Muslim community, and that's what gave rise to different, you know, movements or initiatives. So how would you suggest this particular undertaking to be, in your opinion, different from some of the other undertakings thus far?
Well, I think what we have suggested is, look, there's no doubt there have been movements in the Muslim world, and they've done their work. They were started in certain periods, and on they continue to exist, but you know, very little reflection goes on, very little learning from experiences, very little new creative thinking, and that's what we're calling for. And you know, the movements tend to be very theoretical as well, within a theoretical framework. And what we're saying is, look, we're not trying to replace those movements, but what we're saying is we should all start rethinking ideas, because the world is vastly changed. The world changes all the time. We now have 53 Muslim majority states. We now have social media. Everything is global. In fact, you know, one of the ironies is that, in a sense, you can live in different parts of the world and the boundaries don't matter anymore, because people exist within boundaries, but also outside of those boundaries. And this is a problem not just for the Muslim world, but also for the Western world, where people have their allegiances and their loyalties to groups outside the borders of a state, for example. Again, the Trump movement, the far right, the rise of white identity movements is another example of that. So there is a need for rethinking and analyzing. So we're not saying we've got the whole picture. We're saying we're provoking people to think and say, let's start talking about this, let's start thinking. And to start the ball rolling, our focus is practical. We're saying, regardless of the borders and the governments that we have, here are some practical things that Muslims can do to try and bring about greater unity and unification within their current condition.
And the moment you believe being ripe for such ideas, I mean, obviously in the wake of the pandemic, and that's a very loaded term, but people talking about the great reset, whatever the implications of that is, also very soon, 100 years since the fall of the Ottoman Khilafah. Do you believe, these kind of milestones just give impetus to this kind of thinking?
Yes, I think, look, we have to take into account what's the movements of the past, their thinking, but we have to develop it. At the end of the day, you know, the Quran is a unfolding guidance, as well as, certain key principles which don't change. And the world changes. When the Khilafah fell, the Ottoman Khilafah, there were 15 million people. Even at the height of the Khilafah, there wasn't that number. Today we have, we have 200 million people in Pakistan. We have 1.8 billion Muslims around the world. So the challenges of bringing and uniting these vast populations, which never existed before, are going to be more difficult and complex and require different approaches and methods. So whilst, we accept what there was in the past and the efforts, we have to move and thinking in a way which accepts our current reality. You know, we live, we're one quarter of the world's population. The Earth's population was 1 billion. It took millions of years to get to 1 billion. And then in the next 200 years, it's become 7.8 billion. The problems have become infinitely more complex. We have the nation states. Of course, people lived in those boundaries before. It's not that those people didn't have their nationalities and their ethnicities. The Ottoman state tied them together, but more or less allowed them to continue to rule themselves. So those nations or people, as the Quran describes them, existed. What we have to find is a new way of uniting and bringing people together. The nation states that we have today, the boundaries were not really built around the natural boundaries of where people lived. Different people were brought together. People drew lines on maps. And that, in a way, has confounded the conflict. We were colonized, the wealth was stolen. New states were created. Old institutions were destroyed. We have lots of challenges. Today, we are more... One of the things we look at in the report is that, actually, if you talk about unity... Muslim states are doing most of their export and import with non-Muslim states.
I want to...
We're dependent.
Oh, okay. So, sorry, I lost you there for a minute. You can continue.
No, I was saying that we're not very united, and we are buying all our weapons from the West, so our own wealth is being used to destroy ourselves. So we have to rethink a lot of these things and look at how... practically, we're in a situation of dependency where we can't actually unite with each other because we're so dependent on non-Muslim states.
Does something or the way Muslims respond to the challenges facing the Ummah also today have a lot to do with a psychological state of mind, a state of surrender, or a state of subservience? Do you think, Jahangir, being extremely reactionary, still not having brushed off our shoulders a victim complex?
Oh, I think exactly, and I think we make this point in one of the quotes in the report by Ibn Khaldun, the great thinker, who basically said, a nation can be defeated militarily and it can rise again, but a nation that is defeated psychologically and mentally finds it difficult to rise again. And I guess this is exactly the challenge that we're saying. We're saying to people, look, we can do this. We have to dream big. Ideas do change the world, but you have to not only have ideas, you not only have to communicate those ideas, you have to have the confidence in yourself, and basically you have to work practically and put effort in to achieve them. Talking about them endlessly, as we all have, we all do, isn't the solution. Here are some practical things that we can start working on, and let's not. I mean, even the report, the current climate today that we have in the UK and in the West. I don't know what it's like in South Africa these days, but you can't even discuss these type of things. So we deliberately, used creating a new civilization of Islam. We talk about political issues because even this type of report or discussion has become very controversial amongst Muslims. Muslims no longer have the confidence to talk about these things openly.
And as you mentioned, then the key point is of the institute as well as the report centers around unity. But you do make a differentiation between unity and unification. Would you just like to explain that to us?
Yeah, I think, look, unity is an end goal. We want to be a united ummah, and unity doesn't mean uniformity. Unity means having a practical, unified unity to deal with the rest of the world and your own problems. So we've used the word unification because that's a process, and that the process is the means by which we want to get to the end result, which is unity. You know, I think people always start by saying, yeah, this is unity. We will need to be united, but have little idea what it means. We want to convey that actually this is not something that's going to happen with the click of a finger, or, you know, if we appoint a caliph tomorrow, that suddenly the Muslim world will be united. This is going to be a long process. Because we've been through a long, if you like, dismemberment and deviation, and the time may be long, but you know, we have to strive for that. And you know, others do it. Non-Muslims have done it. The West fights collectively. They don't, even though they're superpowers. They work together and fight together, even in wars. The Muslim world, well, we're acting individually, not collectively. So creating a collective reality is the end goal, and it might start with a few countries, few states, even you know, on the ground, on the grassroots, with civil societies creating associations, but. You know, the result is with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but we have to make the effort.
For you know, correct solutions to be put forward, obviously the problem would need to be diagnosed accurately. In your report, how do you characterize the state of division and the causes of division of Muslims around the world?
Well, I think, again, this is a very complex area, and so we will be doing more research around this, inshallah. But what the way we've looked at it is that, you know, these states emerged after the collapse of the Ottoman Khilafah. Some states emerged before, but essentially they were new states. They started with nothing. There was no reparations for all the theft. You know, the Mughal Empire, for example, was one of the wealthiest in the world. But when the British left, they looted all that wealth. It was a poor country, and they started from scratch. You know, those divisions were sown. There was no economic reparations. Most of these states had no militaries. They had to create new militaries, new armies. They had no finances, were dependent on the West for finances. The educational institutions, the old Islamic institutions that kept the Muslim world together, had been destroyed. So in reality, much of what we had been destroyed. In some countries, even the language, you know, French was the language, even the language had been supplanted. So the divisions and the lack of independence was very deep. And some of those states have started to make progress by building armies and building a nuclear bomb and building economic development. But essentially they are, you know, working towards Western models, but also tied in. They still are tied in to the European powers. As I said, the trade situation, you can look at that. There's total trade dependency on the West. Muslims don't trade with each other. You know, we don't have freedom of movement between Muslim states. We don't have a common language. You know, one of the 12 factors that we talked about is, you know, blocks or alliances of states that are successful usually have a common language. We don't have a common language. And in fact, the imposition of a language on others, when the Ottoman Khilafah was collapsing, the Young Turks tried to impose the Turkification on the Arab countries and their language, and that led to more division. The same happened with Pakistan and Bangladesh, the West Pakistan tried to impose Urdu on the Bangladeshi-speaking population. That didn't work, but we have Arabic as a common language, so we've suggested, look, every Muslim child learns to read Arabic, to pronounce it, to recite it. It wouldn't be a great step up. We're not saying get rid of other languages, but if we had a common language, that would be one factor in helping to bring people a little bit closer together. We've suggested an approach, the economy of brotherhood, looking at how the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam created the souk after he created the masjid. They created the market so the Muslims could make their own living. He created the Treaty of Medina, which was the main means, an alliance of defense and security, which allowed him to continue with his mission. We don't have those alliances, really, between Muslim states. So there's a lot wrong, but equally there's a lot that we can practically raise if we have the right starting point. And I think we're already getting a lot of interest from around the world, people who want to work on some of these ideas, others want to do more research. But it's a long road. I think let's not be under any illusion. The division is deep. We've had, the last Muslim power was the Ottoman state. That's 100 years. Today, 100 years is a long time. And we were even being colonized whilst that state existed. So you can imagine how many hundreds of years of history we have to, and division and dismemberment we have to reverse.
You touched briefly, and there's an interesting piece on the Five Pillars website where you expand on one of those points, and the other points I'm talking about is the 12 factors that unify a people, and on the Five Pillars website you talk about a point that you spoke about just shortly, about how Arabic can create greater social solidarity amongst Muslims. I wanted to ask you, is this your approach? Many times when people look at the problems of the Muslim world, knee-jerk reaction is bemoaning the state of leadership, talking about Muslim nations, talking about the corruptness of leaders, and that in itself has led to entire movements who sometimes take an extreme stance when it comes to the leaders, etc., and that leads to certain results. So is your approach targeted at every rung of society, or are you looking at the individual, developing the individual, and hoping that you get a critical mass of individuals who would be able to tip the balance?
I think we are aiming at all levels of society, really, but we want obviously the thinkers, the ideologues, the civil society, the people who can make things happen. The governments might be corrupt, but there are people within governments who are policymakers and thinkers who are thinking about these things and issues. We need to implant the ideas in a fair segment of the society before that change starts to happen. But sometimes, people are so used to thinking in a particular way. The European ideas and mindset are so afflicted people that the people in those countries actually think like the West. Sometimes just an injection of a different approach, different ideas. A lot of the people in government around the world are actually products of training and ideas and thought processes in the West, and of Western education. They haven't, a lot of people haven't thought about these things. So we've framed the report in a particular way, written it for a very wide audience. Of course, we've also sent it to all the embassies, Muslim embassies, so they can read it and have a think about it. Language, as you mentioned, it's one factor out of the 12. We're not saying it's the only one, but even the RAND report that a U.S. military think tank published in 2004, it actually makes this very point. The dominant language of the Middle East is Arabic. Arabic unifies desperate people. So here they are. The think tanks are telling you that this is what will unite these Muslims. And it says it's not just the language of the Quran. Arabic is more than just conversational and political and mercantile. It contains deep history and religious symbolism. So language also conveys history, ideas, concepts, civilization. And of course, that's precisely the reason why somebody like Ataturk, what did he do? He took all the Arabic words and Persian words out of the language. Even the names, you couldn't even use Arabic and Persian names anymore because he knew exactly what he was doing. He was not just destroying the language of the people, he was destroying their culture, their history, their memory. So this is important, we feel, as a policy, and it's the easiest thing to do. As I say, across 53 Muslim nation states, every Muslim child learns the Quran, learns Arabic. So it's not a great step up if they're taught at school the Arabic language. So I think that's one of the factors. We identify others. The report is on our website to download, ayaninstitute.com. Please do read it. There are 12 factors, very interesting ideas in there for projects. And it's open to everybody. Let's participate in this endeavor, which is, a forgotten obligation, as I say. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us that those who are allied against Islam, they work in alliance, and unless you do this, there will be great corruption on the earth, and that's exactly what we see. We have 53 Muslim-majority states, but we can't even protect the Ummah from genocide. We have 37 million refugees, mostly Muslim, around the world. This situation can only be reversed by Muslims coming together, resolving their own issues and breaking this dependency on the West and being allied together, allies of each other.
The entire object, as you mentioned, is to use the ideas that are put forward in this report as a starting point of discussion. I want to ask you in conclusion then, what is the route to taking these ideas, adding flesh to them, making them practical as you'd like, much more tangible, and how do you hope people listening to this from amongst other audiences should engage with these ideas?
Yeah, so I think, as I say, we're a think tank and we're not aiming to do all of this ourselves. So the first point, important point, is we want to frame embed that new thinking in people. And we're doing that through our website, through our articles, and through video explainers. If you go on our website, you'll find short 2-minute, 3-minute videos on different topics. So we will be doing things like that. We will be looking at more research and projects, and where people are developing those projects, we will encourage them or highlight them. And sometimes on issues like economics, we're planning to do more research, publish reports, and say, look, this is how we have become dependent. Our dependency is this way. For example, the financial markets and the dollar, maybe that's an area of interest that Muslim states are currently locked into. They can't break away from that. And these mechanisms basically hold them as slaves. So sometimes we may it's one of our key areas, economics, to look at more research to do with these issues and put the ideas out there and for others to develop projects. So we encourage people to read the report, think about it, and work on some of the project ideas, but also to propagate the thinking, promote what we're doing on our website and the ideas, and we're getting a good reaction to that.
Indeed, and as the report states in its conclusion, if unification and an alliance of the Muslim world is a goal, then practical ideas, steps, mobilizing of resources, as well as a network of globally interconnected leaders are needed to start along the road to achieve that goal. And this paper is merely the starting point of a discussion with some practical ideas and thoughts on how Muslims can move from their current predicament towards an end goal of unification and empowerment along the lines suggested by the creator. It's 94 pages long, and probably the meat, if you don't have the time, it would be great to read through it all. If you don't, probably the crux of the report, perhaps from my understanding, would be the 12 factors that unify a people, and many ideas would be stimulated by that. It's available on the website of the Ayan Institute, which is ayaninstitute.com, and we have been speaking to the director of the Institute, Mr. Jahangir Mohammed. He's also the author of that report, which is called Creating a New Civilization of Islam. Jahangir, great speaking to you. Much, much more to unpack, and we hope to have many more thought-provoking discussions as time goes by. But for the moment, shukran for your time, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.